With the holiday shopping season upon us, how about a good book or two for the readers on your Christmas list? I'm Kay McIntyre, and today on KPR Presents, the best new books by Kansans or about Kansas. Each year, the State Library of Kansas selects 15 books as Kansas Notable Books. In the first of a two-part series, we'll hear from the authors of seven of those books, including fiction, nonfiction, poetry, young adult literature, and more. This year, only one children's book made the list, Bluebird by Lawrence artist and illustrator Lindsay Yankee. I asked Lindsay to read and describe the first several pages of Bluebird.
Early one spring morning, a little bluebird woke in her nest, eager to fly. As she was about to take off, she stopped. Something was different. Something was missing. Her friend, the wind. Not a leaf in her tree was stirring. I've never flown without the wind, she thought. I'd better find my friend right away. So she jumped down into the park to do just that. She landed by a group of dandelions to see if the wind was there, blowing their seeds away and making wishes. But all the dandelions were still, and each had all of its seeds. And there's a little bird looking at a bunch of dandelions, all kind of made out of mixed media materials and scrap paper and things like that. So with the illustrations for Bluebird, I left a lot of empty space. The story is the bird looking for the wind, and so a lot of the pages kind of have an airy feeling to them, kind of a tea-stained background and oil paints and different textures.
I cannot express enough how much I love the illustrations in this book. How did you come up with the idea of this bluebird looking for the wind and how to convey that with your art?
The story really started a long time ago, maybe like 10 years ago, with the idea of a bird looking for the wind, and that was it. And then I kind of started to develop the story. Well, why is the bird looking for the wind? Where's the wind gone? Where would the bird look for the wind? And so that's when the text and the whole story kind of really started to take more form. And then as far as illustrations go, I was not studying art at that point when I had this idea. And so eventually I found my way to illustration, and I studied illustration at KU and kind of started to refine and kind of figure out what more I wanted to do with my illustrations. And that ended up being a lot of open doors of like different materials and being able to sort through my collage box and pull out pieces and textures that I think would be fun. And so it really just kind of developed in that way.
Although this story could take place anywhere, it's clear that this bluebird is not searching for the wind here in Kansas. Where is this taking place?
I'd say a more European type place. When I was looking for a publisher for Bluebird, I was going to the Children's Book Fair in Bologna, Italy. And that definitely kind of set into my mind like that kind of European architecture and the rooftops and tiles and things like that. And I think that all that stuff is really attractive to my eye. And so I wanted to draw a space that kind of resembled that.
I especially love the illustration where people are sitting in a cafe reading newspapers, and there's bits and pieces of newsprint you can catch in that illustration. What's going on in that scene?
So this scene, there's a little bluebird on every table of the cafe, and she's hanging out by the teacups looking for her friend, the wind blowing along with the newspapers. All of the people at the tables are reading their newspapers, and the newspapers themselves are clips from the newspaper. I can't remember what edition it was, but it was right after Barack Obama won the first election. So that kind of tells you how long I've been working on this. And I thought it was also kind of like a nice homage to like the time frame that I was making it and kind of the important events that were happening. And so there's lots of little scraps of paper and like underlying layers throughout the book. That's definitely the most obvious one.
This isn't your first children's book, is it?
No. Well, yes and no. I did, the year before Bluebird came out, I did 20 illustrations for a collection of short stories that were English author from like the 1800s translated into the first Italian edition. And so I got to read all those stories and do the illustrations for that. But that's more like young adult stuff. So it's more like a chapter book. But as far as picture books that I have written and illustrated, yes, Bluebird's the first.
As an illustrator and as an artist, what's it like for you actually coming up with a story rather than just sort of having a free hand to do whatever strikes your fancy?
I think that that's something that I really learned that I liked in school, and just like from having an assignment and just having some parameters. I think that that is when I was able to like kind of get creative within that and kind of push those boundaries. And so having the framework of a book, and kind of having the framework of a story or a narrative, I know kind of a little bit of my limits, but I can push them and I can explore within them instead of being so open that I just kind of get lost and I flounder for too long and then you just put something away and then it's done. So I'd say that having a story and having a narrative definitely helps kind of guide my creative process and knowing the parts of the story that can influence the illustrations and vice versa and how they can say more with the text and less with the picture or more with the picture and less with the text and still be informative.
Like I said, I thought this was a lovely, lovely book. And if you've got young readers in your household or just love a good picture book, this is a really lovely one.
Thank you, Kay.
Lindsay, what's ahead for you as an artist, as a children's book author?
Well, I've got a couple stories in mind that I worked around with earlier in the summer, and I've been doing more craft fairs this fall, and I think that like early winter time I'm going to hibernate and work on a new story and a new book. So,
okay, we'll look forward to that. You can check out Lindsay's work at lindsayyankee.com.
Thank you so much.
Our next Kansas Notable book also relies heavily on the visual image. Railroad Empire Across the Heartland is a book of side-by-side photographs showing the striking difference between frontier Kansas of the 1860s and today. The older photographs are by Alexander Gardner. The new photographs are by Lawrence photographer John Charlton, with exposition by Jim Chereau of Manhattan. They join me at the Kansas Book Festival in Topeka.
Let's start with an easy question. Who was Alexander Gardner?
Well, how much time do we have?
5 minutes.
5 minutes. Okay. He was Scottish-born, a reformer, came to the United States, set up a farm in Iowa, a utopian farm, didn't work. Eventually gets to Washington, D.C., decides to become a photographer, works for the Brady outfit, and eventually strikes off on his own and does Civil War photography. A lot of the most famous Civil War battle scenes are his. He does other photography, Lincoln's portraits, did Lincoln's last surviving portrait. And then the Union Pacific Eastern Division, later becomes the Kansas Pacific, later the Union Pacific, hired him to do photographs of the building of the railroad across Kansas and all the way to eventually San Francisco, where he ended his photography of the route. And so Gardner was an amazing photographer, very, very well known in national circles.
Do you know why the railroad wanted to document?
Oh, yes. John Perry, the president of the railroad, was running into some problems. Reports came back to President Johnson that the railroad wasn't being very well built. This was jeopardizing the land grants for it. It was jeopardizing the bonds for it. And so Perry wanted to have it well established through photography and also through great expeditions, taking senators, representatives, newspapermen across also the tracks that had been built, showing them, look, that this railroad works, it's being well built, please give us the land grants. So that was the motive for hiring Gardner.
All right, let's jump forward to 1993. Why retrace Alexander Gardner's steps?
After learning about the Gardner series that was in the Kansas State Historical Society, I realized that it was a very historical early portrait of the state in its earliest stages of development along the railroad, and that it would be an excellent basis of a rephotographic survey to document the changes that had occurred, only it probably should have been done a lot earlier. And since no one had done it yet, and I felt I had the background to do it, I decided that this would be my project.
So you took his original photographs and set out to find the exact same spot where that picture was taken and to re-photograph it. What were some of the challenges in doing so?
All kinds, because so much of the state of Kansas is private land. There's very few public lands, and of course it was all actually after, say, Junction City, at the time Gardner was here, it was open frontier. There were only a few new towns and settlements. There weren't counties. There weren't roads. There weren't, you know, there were a few place names. So even the old maps are not very useful. But there was railroad miles that Gardner used to document his locations. And those made it easier to find. And so even when everything had changed completely that would be the subject of the photographs, I could kind of verify the locations both by using the original railroad mileage that was on Gardner's photographs, and then try to match the photographic lighting conditions that are seasonally should be identical if you know when Gardner's pictures were taken. And that was also documented. So I had the information I really needed to do that. And it was all pretty much a visual imaging process.
One of the photographs that stands out remarkably, there's two of them, two sets that stand out for me. One is of Wamego. Gardner took the photograph standing on the south side of the tracks, looking north along Lincoln Street. And it's just some frame buildings, hardly anything there. There are a few trees that are planted, and then in the background to the north is just wide open grassland. You look at that same location today, and it's a very different urban setting, fully treed. You can't even see beyond a couple blocks because of all the trees to the north. So something's gone on there that accounts for why this kind of vegetation is there and it wasn't there previously. The other photograph pairing that I think illustrates this to a degree, where John was taking these photographs of, it's called Inscription Rock, I think it is. And so there are all these paleo hieroglyphics carved into the sandstone. We're not sure who those people were who put them there, and we're not sure what they stood for. But Gardner certainly captured these hieroglyphics beautifully. You go to the same place today, there's a different set of hieroglyphics. One says Wichita, one says John and Amy, and so forth. And what these hieroglyphics of the 1990s, 2000s indicate is sort of the eradication and erasure of that previous culture that had carved itself into the sandstone. And it's a beautiful metaphor for what was happening to the landscape. You have an Indian-managed landscape that Gardner was catching the early transformation of it and catching places where that transformation hadn't even occurred yet. And then we have John's photographs of this same transformation wrought 150 years later.
That's Jim Chereau of Manhattan, along with photographer John Charlton of Lawrence. Their Kansas notable book is Railroad Empire Across the Heartland, Re-Photographing Alexander Gardner's Westward Journey. Our next Kansas notable book also harkens back to the 1860s, 1862 to be exact.
It's the second year of the Civil War, and a regiment of Kansas soldiers is making history. It's the 1st Kansas Colored Infantry, the first Black unit to see combat during the Civil War. Dr. Ian Michael Spurgeon is a military historian with the U.S. Defense Department. His book is Soldiers in the Army of Freedom.
This is an unfortunately little-known unit. More Kansans and more Americans really need to know about it. It's the first Black regiment to see combat during the Civil War. Unfortunately, most people direct their attention towards the East and to the 54th Massachusetts, which was a fantastic regiment. But the 1st Kansas Colored was raised and went into combat several months before the 54th Massachusetts. And it's a story that more people need to know about.
So talk to me about the role of Senator James Henry Lane.
Oh, yeah. He is the most important person for the creation of this regiment. And he had a lot of faults. He was a very controversial man, a very, very interesting man. But he was, I guess, the most important thing to say about for his role with the regiment, he hated secession. He saw the Civil War as a continuation of Bleeding Kansas. And so for him, he hit the ground running in 1861, 1862, was carrying out really what we would recognize in a more popular sense, William Tecumseh's kind of total war idea, William Tecumseh Sherman's total war. And so Lane wanted to punish secessionists. And even though Missouri was not technically a state of the Confederacy, there was a large pro-Confederate population there and a lot of guerrillas moving around. And it was back and forth, of course. But for Lane, he saw an opportunity. He saw an opportunity to raise soldiers that Kansas badly needed, and the white population was pretty small, wasn't large enough to really outfit the number of regiments they needed. And he saw these hundreds and even thousands of fugitive slaves fleeing from Missouri, fleeing from Indian Territory, and fleeing from Arkansas into Kansas. And these are strong, able-bodied men, and they are former slaves, and Lane sees this as the ultimate form of vengeance. Giving them weapons, turning them on the secessionists, punishing the South, and relieving some of the pressure on the white population. And he had a lot of abolitionist officers who had been combat veterans from white units ready to train and lead these men. And so Kansas really actually turned out to be a very good location for what was really a radical step in 1862 when this regiment was first created.
You know, just out of sheer coincidence, I've been watching this past week Ken Burns' epic miniseries on the Civil War. And one of the things they talked about in that series is for Confederates, how terrifying the sight of armed African-American soldiers would be.
Yes. And it was a radical step for most in the North in 1861. The only reason Black soldiers really are raised and recruited in Kansas and across the Union is because the war is stretching on, because it is becoming a long, bloody conflict in which the white regiments are sustaining casualties. They need to keep incorporating more and more soldiers for these campaigns, and there's a need. But even then, there were still a lot of people in the North that saw that as too radical, because this meant equality. You know, military service was a path to equality. And in the South, it was what they called servile insurrection. I mean, this was the ultimate fear that had gone back for decades in the South, with slaves uprising, grabbing weapons, and fighting their masters. And so that's actually what was appealing to some people like Lane, is saying, with secession and this really almost total war, let's turn one of that greatest fear against them. And what they had to really show was that Black soldiers could fight effectively, and the 1st Kansas Colored was very, very effective and proved that to be the soldiers very capable.
With that in mind, talk to me about the importance of the skirmish at Island Mound in western Missouri.
Yes, this is recognized as the first time a Black unit went into combat during the Civil War. It was a small skirmish for Civil War standards by then. It's late October 1862. It's after the big battles of First Bull Run, Second Bull Run, Antietam, Shiloh, where you have thousands of white soldiers and thousands of casualties. So something small, which involved really, at total, a number were 250 soldiers from the 1st Kansas Colored Infantry, and about 700 or so total Confederate guerrillas were in the area, and actually engaged in the battle were just a couple hundred Confederates and about 100 or so of the Black soldiers. That's a small skirmish. That's not something that really got a lot of headlines. And it was significant in the fact, though, it was the first time that Black unit, organized Black unit that was not actually mustered into federal service. The 1st Kansas was still a state organization, still being recruited, had not been accepted in federal service, But the Kansas troops and Kansas officers along the Missouri border, they needed more troops. And they gave these guys the opportunity there in October 1862 to chase out some Missouri guerrillas in that area. And the 1st Kansas Colored performed very, very well.
Am I right in thinking that, these soldiers in the Kansas 1st were not paid for their service?
Not at first. This is what's to understand the hardships of what these soldiers were going through. I estimate about 95% of the 1st Kansas Colored Infantry were former slaves, that were slaves up until right the point when they joined or had escaped slavery at some point during the previous year or a few months or so. Many of them were very excited with it for the opportunity to fight. I'll also add, though, these guys are mostly illiterate, so we've had to try to reconstruct their story based on whatever resources can come about, articles in newspapers written about them at the time or pensions. And these guys are joining, often these young men, illiterate, and they see this as an opportunity to fight for their own freedom. They see it as an opportunity to fight for the freedom of their families, I mean, in a very literal sense, as well as against slavery overall. But they're also very worried that their service is not going to be utilized effectively, that they're going to be used for manual labor. They are first given, in 1862, secondhand uniforms. They're given secondhand muskets, some of which don't operate, some of which are dangerous to use, and they're not paid. Initially, they were told they were supposed to be paid at a lower rate than white soldiers, according to a militia act based on the federal government. But these men, and desertion rates were pretty high, because these men really had a lot going against them. They had a lot of critics, they did not have the best equipment, and they weren't sure they were going to be used effectively. But again, because there was such that need, and they had good, strong support from white Kansas officers, James Blunt, and then politicians like James Lane, eventually they did receive their pay and much better equipment.
Can I have you read an excerpt?
Yes, yeah. Like their white counterparts in the war, the men of the 1st Kansas Colored Infantry overcame obstacles with pride and suffered from injury, disease, fear, and homesickness. Some deserted, some resisted military authority, and some served quietly with few records to distinguish them from any other soldier, black or white, during the Civil War. They were brave and afraid, sometimes capable of extraordinary feats, but also of all too human frailties. Perhaps they fought with a tenacity that only ages of bondage can inspire. But the one thing that clearly separated them from white soldiers was the ever-present knowledge that if captured by Confederate forces, they faced almost certain death or a return to slavery in southern states. They finished the war with a remarkable combat record, worthy of a place among the hardest fighting regiments of the war. And they played a vital part in helping to begin the long and painful process of countering white prejudice by defying stereotypes. They simply wanted the opportunity to show that they were men, not property, and that was and remains the point. Too long overlooked, this is their story.
That's Dr. Ian Michael Spurgeon reading from his book, Soldiers in the Army of Freedom, the 1st Kansas Colored, the Civil War's first African-American combat unit. I spoke with him and most of the authors featured on today's program at the 5th Annual Kansas Book Festival held in Topeka on September 12, 2015. Each year, the Kansas Book Festival honors the 15 winners of the Kansas Notable Book Award. We're featuring 7 of those books on today's KPR Presents. The list usually includes several YA or young adult books. The Kansas Notables list has only one YA book this year, Girl in Reverse by Barbara Stuber of Mission Hills. It's her second time on the Kansas Notable list. Her debut novel, Crossing the Tracks, won in 2011. Her new book, Girl in Reverse, was chosen by NPR's Book Concierge as one of the best YA books of the year and was named by the International Literacy Association as a YA honor book. It's the story of Lily Firestone, an Asian girl growing up in Kansas City in the early 1950s at the height of the Korean War.
Lily was put in an orphanage in Kansas City at the age of one and a half, and adopted to white American parents at the age of three, but her ethnicity is Chinese. So somehow in her history, her birth mother had traveled all the way from China and then to San Francisco, Angel Island, and then all across the country, halfway across to Kansas City, and left her daughter, whose name was Leanne at the time, in an orphanage in Kansas City. And then her birth mother, as Lily tends to think of it, turned into gone mom and disappeared. So the story has to do with Lily, number one, figuring out her true creation story. Who was that woman and why Kansas City, and what it means for her to be in Kansas City. There's a link there. So I also am a docent at the Nelson Atkins Museum, and we have a huge Chinese collection there, which I has worked on me for the 25 years I've been a docent there. So the sublime side of China, the beauty of those thousands-year-old cultures in China, played a big role in the story and in Lily's own discovery of her provenance or her backstory, her true story.
In her search for her identity, she encounters a nun, Sister Evangeline, mm-hmm. and I want to read a quote from your book. Sister Evangeline says, "A complicated past is best understood a bit at a time."
That is in part because, well, of course, Lily's history is very complicated, and bits and pieces of her past are literally artifacts, Chinese artifacts that she didn't know belonged to her that she finds. So a bit at a time plays a metaphor in the bits and pieces, literally, of objects, and also because you have something that's very dynamic and has lots of pieces to it, you can't take it in all at once. You have to do it a bit at a time. Find your way, stepping stones into your history.
Why have her be Chinese at the time of the Korean War? What was it about that setting and that ethnicity of her character?
China had just become involved in the Korean War, and they were supporting the North Koreans in China, and they were our mortal enemies, the U.S.'s mortal enemy. Where we had been allies during World War II, now we're mortal enemies. So the Red Threat was at its height, and in a work of fiction, if you want the conflict to be at its peak, at its pinnacle, you would put a Chinese girl in an all-white setting at a height of a moment when the world, our United States, is doing everything it can to demonize the Chinese, you know, propaganda against. So it puts Lily in this very tough spot in her high school, inside her own skin, on the bus, on the playground, everywhere she goes. And she is being bullied in the name of patriotism. And back in that day, that was let go. Nobody kept that from happening. So she couldn't be American, and she couldn't be Chinese, either one.
The title of the book, Girl mm-hmm. in Reverse, what does that mean to you?
Well, in the art world, where I spend a lot of time, understanding a precious object, whether it's a painting or a sculpture, whatever, its reverse means understanding its backstory. Not just who painted it and why, but maybe who owned it, what it's connected to, who even stole it, who fixed it. And it adds to the value of an artwork to know its reverse, its backstory. Literally can add to its value. So I'm using the word reverse here for Lily to refer to her own backstory, her own value, knowing the pieces, the broken pieces of her past that can be puzzled together and make her whole.
And make her more valuable.
Yes. Where so far she has felt like she is of zero value at all, lost in place.
That's a lovely analogy from the art world.
Yeah. Actually, the working title of the book was Provenance, because that bridges all that. But I knew that word would not work because nobody can.
People would be like,
you know,
what
it sounds kind of hoity-toity, blah, blah. But Girl in Reverse, plus, it really is saying the same thing. And it's nice to have a title that has some action. It implies action. It's not just like, you know, one word. It's an action that you can see she's contemplating.
Barbara, can I get you to read an excerpt from Girl in Reverse?
We are sitting at the dinner table with Lily Firestone and her brother Ralph, who is a natural-born son of her parents, and her mother and father. Almost always at the dinner table, it's a tense time, and Ralph tends to have the ability to light the family up with something that is going to be controversial, or he's going to definitely get stuck with the dishes afterwards for having brought up something difficult. So toward the end of dinner, these words pop from Ralph's mouth and crash on the table. "Say, everybody, I have something." "It's more a question, really," he turns to Dad. "When kids get adopted," he pauses. "Adopted shatters our chandelier, pierces the ceiling." Mother dabs her mouth, leaving two mauve smears on her napkin. "Well, like when they're 4 or 5 years old or something, does the orphan get to bring all his stuff with him to the new people, pictures and clothes from the orphanage, or, you know, what happens to all his stuff?" Mother leans in, grips the table edge, and glances at my father. "It is gotten rid of." Dad tips his head, blinks, presumably considering the correct legal answer. Our mother shivers, turns to her husband. "It's best. Why should a child be encouraged to live in reverse?" Her face looks a mix of amen and damn it. My mind exits the dining room and enters the little girl's dorm at the Sisters of Mercy Children's Home. I see the scratchy green wool blanket on my metal bed there, seventh down on the right side, and my pink plastic hairbrush labeled Lillian, and my locker stacked with pajamas and undershirts. I smell the incense smoke floating in the chapel. My reverse. "But technically, shouldn't the thing still belong to the kid?" Ralph insists. Dad does not look at me. He chuckles a phony, "Oh, now there's a doozy," kind of a laugh, and says, "If you don't follow in my footsteps in the construction business, son, you've got the makings of a fine attorney." No one has asked Ralph why he's asking such a question. No one has asked what I think. Mother stands like a juggler who has lost her pins. She turns and studies her face in the mirror above the buffet, then glares at her precious crystal cabinet. She walks out, lifts the new McCall's off the mail pile in the front hall, and heads upstairs to the tiny, upholstered place inside herself with no adopted Chinese daughter, no smarty 11-year-old Boy Scout, no old orphan belongings, no commies or chinks or Korean War, just bridge mix, manicures, darning, and solitaire. "Don't live in reverse." That's my mother's always summing things up, exiting a difficult conversation before it starts. In our house, hard topics are either swirled away in a glass of bourbon or wrapped in sandpaper and swallowed.
That's Barbara Stuber reading from Girl in Reverse. It's one of 15 books selected by the State Library of Kansas as this year's Kansas Notable Books. If you missed last week's program, part one of our annual Kansas Notable show, it's now archived on our website, kpr.ku.edu. I'm Kay McIntyre. You're listening to KPR Presents on Kansas Public Radio. There are two books of poetry among this year's Kansas Notable Books, We featured one of them, Chasing Weather by Karen Miriam Goldberg and photographer Stephen Locke, on last week's program. Now we'll turn to the second book of poetry. Music I Once Could Dance To is by Roy Beckmeyer of Wichita.
I always like to read a love poem when I begin my readings. And one of the things I tell people often is that a love poem does not have to have the word love appear in it. A love poem may not seem at all like a love poem to anyone but the person to whom it's written. And this is called At Watermark Books Before the Reading. It's dedicated to my wife, Pat. Having arrived early, we browse the tables of books. I watch you wandering, your hands held out before you as if they're dowsing sticks. You always do that, your hands dipping and bobbing to the hidden rush of words that you somehow sense are splashing and swirling between the covers. You open the book with a smile, and words pour out across the page, washing over your divining hands, words that reflect light the way creek water does as it stumbles over stones. And you look up, catch my eye, cup your hands, and motion for me to share a cold sip from this well of words that you have found.
That's lovely.
Thank you.
Why is it that you like to start out your readings with a love poem?
Well, I started writing poetry in high school. I wrote love poems to my girlfriend, and she became my wife, and we've been married 54 years now. So it's kind of back to the origins of why I wrote poetry.
It worked.
In the first place. It worked.
All right, the second poem I'd like you to read is Zeb in White and Black. Oh,
very good. I've lived in Kansas for more years than I've lived anywhere else, but I grew up in the prairies of Illinois. And in southern Illinois, the prairies are underlain by coal, and coal mining was a very early industry there. This is called Zeb in White and Black. He had the habitual cough, the defining cough, that marked him as a southern Illinois coal miner. The cough, fed by black, inky spots deep within his chest, that had him constantly hacking up what remained of his lungs into a white handkerchief. After all those years underground, surrounded by coal, now he delivered it in his battered pickup. We nephews and nieces rode along, perched on lumps of coal or on the sides of the pickup bed, streaks of black on our faces, dusty black hands. Zeb's hands were perpetually outlined, the cuticle of his nails, the whorls and ridges of his fingerprints, all etched in black. You noticed it particularly when his left hand held white cigarette paper in a V shape, or when his right hand clutched the white cloth bag, tapping out a line of tobacco. The black was still there when I last saw him. Even the undertaker's careful, attentive work had not been able to clean those fingers. And I can still see the black marks on his folded hands, stark against the pristine white satin that lined the coffin. The coal-black coffin that would cradle him forever in his mine-dark grave.
Hmm. That really paints a picture.
It does, and I can still see him. I can picture him in my mind when I read that poem. So,
if you flip maybe one more page, there's a poem, Going Home,
yes,
on page 89 that I just loved.
Oh, thank you. Perhaps the most famous Kansas poet is William Stafford, who was born in Hutchinson. And his poems always inspire me, perhaps because a lot of his Kansas poems in particular relate to small towns. And there's a line from his poem. The title of his poem is "It Still Happens Now," and the line is, "You make me walk my town till I'm drowned in time." And that just really struck me, because every time I go back to Illinois and to the town I grew up in, it seems like I'm walking back in time. So this is called "Going Home." There is no anonymity in this small town, where each tombstone might just as well be a portrait. Everyone recognizes my father's ears astride my striving face. "The J doesn't stand for junior," I insist, but they all think it does. So here I am. I have wandered the world, but will always belong to the stark frame house where the swing rope dangles and corn pollen dusts the path once daily traversed by my father's morning shadow. The sign at the edge of town has said, "Population 1,000, forever." I walk the cemetery, stalk the rows, search the memorials for that one particular face I know must have gone missing on the day when I was born.
That's Roy Beckmeyer of Wichita reading from his collection of poetry, "Music I Once Could Dance To." I'm Kay McIntyre. You're listening to our annual Kansas Notable Book Show, Part 2. We're on the home stretch with just two more Kansas Notable books to go. If you've ever looked out on a prairie field and wondered, just what is all that grass? Our next book is for you. Ira Lee Bernard of Hope, Kansas wrote "Field Guide to the Common Grasses of Oklahoma, Kansas, and Nebraska." It's published by University Press of Kansas.
For most people, maybe the prairie seems kind of daunting or overwhelming because it's so huge. And often the metaphor that you see that people often use is ocean.
Sure.
It's an ocean with the undulating green hills and the waving prairie grasses. And maybe like an ocean, it's just so open and flat that it kind of scares some people. But some people also think of it as freedom, that openness. And the way to really appreciate the prairie is to get out in the prairie, to actually sit there for a little while and to look around you and to notice all the things, the dozens of flowers that are blooming and the bees that are buzzing and the wind in your hair, and just experience it. And I think that's how you really learn about the prairie and get familiar with it.
How did you learn about prairie grasses? How did you become interested in this subject of grasslands?
Well, I guess I was always interested in nature and always enjoyed the outdoors. And from that, it just kind of, one thing led to another. And it really was when my husband and I first moved to the prairie. We live out in the country, and it was 40 years ago. And that's when I started studying the plants and getting to know all of the plants, and eventually working over at K-State in the herbarium, where I learned even more about plants and grasses. I guess I just have always enjoyed it, and it was something I was lucky enough to get a chance to learn more about.
Why are the grasslands so important?
Well, the grasslands are important, like so many ecosystems, just for themselves, for what they contribute, for the diversity that they have. And each is a little bit different, but has a place. And for us here in Kansas, it's a economy. We have a lot of cattle ranching and a reason that the grasses provide an income for us here in Kansas.
What made you decide to write this book?
I was kind of like a light bulb came on one day. I guess I was out with a friend, and I thought, you know, these are so special, and it's so hard to find information about grasses. There's not a lot of books about grasses, especially in Kansas, and those that we have are really outdated. And I thought another thing is, you see books that are just a lot of text and you've got a lot of measurements, and that's, you know, not any fun, and people like pictures. And I thought, oh, pictures, that's the way that people will get to enjoy the grasses. And so that's what set me off, was getting started with pictures. I kind of took a few and I thought, well, I think this will work, but now what do I do? I had never written a book before. So I contacted the publisher, and that was the beginning of the book.
Your book is full of wonderful pictures of all kinds of grasses that grow in Kansas and Oklahoma and Nebraska. But my favorite photograph in your book is the one that's found on page 10 or page X of the preface. Can you describe that picture for me and talk about how you went about taking these pictures of the grasslands?
Yeah, that I was... fortunate to be out with some good friends, family, that were helping me take my picture, and that's how I got my picture on there. It was a picture of me that you're referring to.
A picture of you taking pictures of grasses.
Of grasses, yes. And I guess there's several ways you can approach that, and I kind of looked into that for photography. And one is... to use flash. If you use flash, you can kind of set the plant, it sets the plant apart. You highlight the plant that you're after. And another way is to just put a contrasting board of some sort behind the plant. But that's kind of difficult when you've got very large plants to be out in the field and take these boards with you. And I had seen in an older publication that his method was to actually just move the plant to a location where he could take photographs, and that seemed to work so well that I decided that was the way to go. And so that's the way most of the photographs were taken.
It's just a nice visual reminder of the physical act of how do you photograph a single blade of grass in a way that makes it identifiable and that you can see the structures and the things that help you identify what type that is.
Well, you have to look closely. And all of these things, I tried to select things that people could see. At least I thought I could see them. And I thought, well, if I can, most people will be able to see them, because a lot of the grass structures are pretty tiny. So a lot of the photographs are maybe larger than life. But I do have different sections of the book, and there's one with the leaf comparisons where they're all life size so that you can kind of see them side by side.
This might seem like a strange question, but of all the different kinds of grasses that grow in this area of the country, do you have a favorite?
Well, I think it's like my wildflowers. It's sort of a favorite just depending on my mood. But one of my favorite grasses is porcupine grass. And it's such a pretty grass, and it's so interesting and so different. And so I just love that grass. It's got long awns, and the awns sort of, when you see it, you'll know they just drape out, and they look actually like porcupine quills, so that's how it got its name.
Irelee, you have a number of quotes in your book. I'd like you to open it up to page 36 and read a couple of the quotes that you have about grasses.
The first quote is, "To the casual observer, the grasses are but grass, and to few is their diversity, their beauty, and their value apparent." And this is by Mary Frances Baker, from the Book of Grasses in 1912. The second is John Weaver from North American Prairie, which was written or published in 1954. And his quote says, "Nature is an open book for all those who care to read. Each grass-covered hillside is a page on which is written the history of the past, the conditions of the present, and the predictions of the future. Some see without understanding, but let us look closely."
That's Irelee Bernard of Hope, Kansas, reading from Field Guide to the Common Grasses of Oklahoma, Kansas, and Nebraska. Kansas Public Radio has a copy of that book to give away, as well as many of the Kansas Notable books featured on today's program. If you'd like a chance to win a Kansas Notable book, go to our website, kpr.ku.edu, click on Extras, and then Giveaways. Again, that's kpr.ku.edu. We'll also be giving away a copy of our final Kansas Notable book. It's Ad Astra, 161 Adventurers, Astronauts, Discoverers, Explorers, Pilots, Pioneers, and Scientists. Ad Astra is by Dave Webb, Terry Rombeck, and Becky Tanner, published by the Kansas Heritage Center in Dodge City. It's the first of what's hoped to be a 9-part series called 999 Kansas Characters, a biographical series. I spoke with Dave Webb and Becky Tanner at the Kansas Book Festival in Topeka.
Thanks to the internet and the other ease of research nowadays, it was very easy to gather a mass, a huge collection of interesting folks with Kansas connections. So rather than try to put them all between two covers, we divided it. It's essentially in 9 sections, but we're not sure that we'll get all 9 sections published. This is number 1 of a series, we hope.
What would you say that these 161 characters have in common with each other?
They all either reach or reached out in some way. Some explored what later became Kansas. Some explored in the field of medicine. Some explored in space and aviation. Essentially, someone who was a pioneer. The only quintessential pioneer, I guess, we have is Ada McCall, who was is better known as the cowchip woman on the covers of several books. But these people all made an effort to go above and beyond where they had been. And they either did so in Kansas or they were born in Kansas and went elsewhere to make a name for themselves.
Your book has a lot of very familiar names to Kansans in terms of pioneers and explorers, but it also has a lot of people that most of us have never heard of. Becky, I'd like you to just pick out one person that we may not have heard of and tell me about him or her.
Well, one of my favorites is Worth Siegendahler. One of the things that I work at the Eagle, I've worked there for 32 years, it always amazes me how we continually shape our history, that there are always people that are coming to the front that we may not have heard about. Worth Siegendahler grew up in Hoisington, and he became one of the nation's top physicists and worked on the Manhattan Project. And he actually was considered a cram boy. Winston Cram was an incredible physics teacher. And you know the expression of how we cram for a test?
Yeah.
That was from Winston Cram from Emporia. And
Seriously?
And Worth Siegendahler was one of the cram boys. That's what they were nicknamed back in the 30s and whatnot. But he went on to work for the Manhattan Project. And I love the story on him. We used a ball-peen hammer to illustrate it. But he was part of the new crowd, and he had to work the late shift. And at one point, he had the fate of the Western world in his hands. He was working late at night, and he was working with the plutonium. And there was this silver sphere that he had to put the plutonium in. And he dropped it. And he caught one half of it, but the other half fell on a table and dented. And so he did what any Kansas farm boy would do.
Panic?
No. And there were armed guards at the door and all of that. So he goes out, he goes to a garden shed, he gets a gas mask and a ball-peen hammer, comes back in, and slowly taps the other sphere back into place, taking the dent out so that the plutonium would fit in the ball. And I mean, it's an incredible story. And yeah, we don't know about him. But, you know, in recent years, that's come to light. And he also was one of the first people to witness the atomic bomb when it went off.
Talk about keeping a cool head under pressure.
Absolutely.
Dave, I'm going to ask you to pick out another character that we may not have heard of.
I guess I might mention, this is a well-known person, but he does have a Kansas connection. He did have a Kansas connection, and that's Charles Lindbergh. Charles Lindbergh was not born in Kansas, and he was taking flying lessons in Nebraska when the little company he worked for back in the beginning days of aviation went bankrupt. And the planes were sold to a gentleman in Bird City in far northwest Kansas that had an air circus. And because Lindbergh had not completed his training, the deal included him to go with the planes and be taught how to fly. And so he did, and in the summer of 1923, he spent flying in and out of his home base at Bird City. And you might say, well, does a few weeks or 3 months in the summer qualify him as a Kansan? But I will point out that he was good friends with several of the Wichita aviators. Walter Beach especially was a good friend, and Lindbergh approached him about building a plane that would cross the Atlantic. Mr. Beach refused, and it was never spoken out loud, but the supposition was that Mr. Beach was a little hesitant to build a plane that might go down in history as having killed a young man trying to fly across the Atlantic. So instead of the Spirit of Wichita, he flew across the Atlantic in the Spirit of St. Louis. However, he did keep his Kansas connections. He came back to Wichita several times and visited his aviator friends. He came to Dodge City and helped choose the site for the airport. He and Amelia Earhart were involved with a railroad plane combination where early kind of daring passengers flew in Ford tri-motor planes in the daytime across the country, and then they landed in one case on the Santa Fe Railroad at Garden City, and in another case at Winoka, Oklahoma, just south of Wellington, Kansas, traveled by sleeper car at night, and then early the next morning at their destination, they would get on planes and fly again. It was the fastest way to cross the country at that time, and Lindbergh was one of the shareholders and founders of the companies that did that. And when he wrote his autobiography of his famous solo flight, in one section he writes very eloquently about flying low over the waves, and those waves reminded him of the waving fields of Kansas wheat that he had flown over as he first learned to fly.
So why 161?
That's just where we stop.
Okay. There's nothing magic about that number.
No. As I said, the 999 is based on all these categories, and actually in the database I've been collecting, we have about 1,400 names of potential Kansas characters.
We were afraid that if we didn't publish soon, it would be the book would be 10 inches thick, so it helps to just divide it.
Excellent. Well, I look forward to the second installment coming out maybe next year.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's Dave Webb and Becky Tanner. Along with Terry Rombeck, they're the authors of Ad Astra, 161 Adventurers, Astronauts, Discoverers, Explorers, Pilots, and Scientists, published by the Kansas Heritage Center in Dodge City. It was one of 15 books selected by the State Library of Kansas this year as Kansas Notable Books. Do join us on next week's KPR Presents for part two of our annual Kansas Notable Books program. Kansas Public Radio has several Kansas Notable Books to give away. If you'd like a chance to win one of them, go to our website, kpr.ku.edu. Click on Extras and then Available Giveaways. Again, that's kpr.ku.edu. I'm Kay McIntyre. KPR Presents is a production of Kansas Public Radio at the University of Kansas.